From the American Tobacco Historic District, this is The State of Things. I'm David Crabtree. What started out as an accusation of rape turned into Durham's struggle with sexism, racism, and classism. It's now become a full-fledged national media frenzy. The media attention that has descended on Duke University and on Durham in the past 6 weeks shows no signs of letting up. But why has this story garnered so much national scrutiny? Has the coverage been fair to both sides? And is it what readers and listeners really want? Today we're talking about whether this coverage is a reflection of what the public really wants or if it's what the media wants the public to want. Joining me in the studio now is Ted Vaden. Ted is the public editor at the News and Observer of Raleigh. Ted, welcome.
Thank you, David.
And we welcome your calls and emails this hour, 1-877-962-9862 or SOT at WUNC.org. Ted, basically, your response to the Duke LaCrosse incident, as far as the News and Observer is concerned, scale of 1 to 10, where do you rate it?
I guess I'm going to be sort of evasive on that. I'd put it between a 5 and a 10 as far as the quality of our coverage goes, and probably closer to a 10. Today is a landmark day in the history of this story because it's the first day that I can find for some time, a month or so, that we haven't had a story at all in the paper about the Duke LaCrosse story. I counted at one point, and there were something like 24 of the 28 previous days that story had been on the front page of the News and Observer. I think that there are two things that readers can ask of any story in our paper, and for that matter, any other kind of media outlet. One is it accurate? And two, is it fair? We've had a lot of questions from readers about those issues. I don't think anybody would find fault with the NNO, certainly on the accuracy part of it. I don't. I have not seen issues in there where we've been wrong about the facts. I haven't had people call me, and I haven't seen corrections that we've had to issue on it. So I think that we've done a good job of getting the story right. I have had concerns expressed to me on issues of fairness. This is a story that evokes strong emotions from people. You've got these issues of race and sex and class and privilege and all these other things that really excite people, and people tend to view the coverage through their own lenses of how they view the world. And I think that has a lot to do with it. But I think in general, in the broad strokes, the coverage has been fair. We have, the newspaper has, yes, pointed a spotlight at the Duke LaCrosse team and that so-called culture. It's looked hard at Duke itself and raised questions about its relationship with the community, for instance. But it has also looked closely at the record of the police record of the accuser, as well as the accused. And it's looked closely at the DA who's brought all these charges in terms of the political context in which they've been brought.
You know, covering a story like this, although we haven't necessarily seen many stories like this, but in the broad brushstroke of covering a story like this, it can be fatiguing for all concerned. Are you tired of it?
Yeah, and in fact, I think our readers are to some extent, too. I got an email from a reader the other day that said, I would like to call for a one-day quiet period on the Duke LaCrosse stories. Let's face it, if God took 1 day and 7 to rest, we can take a breather from this story. Big news stories like this, my experience is, are sort of organic. They take on a life of their own. They're born, they grow, they get more visible and vibrant. And then they sort of play out over time and ultimately die. This has got a long ways before it dies, but it is going through that organic life cycle, I guess.
We're going to have some other guests on the program this day as well. But before we get to our next guest, let's take a phone call. We are taking your phone calls this afternoon. Let's take this one from Stuart in Benson. Stuart?
Hey, how are you doing?
I'm doing well, thank you. What's on your mind?
Well, the thing that's on my mind is that although this event, if it actually occurred, is a horrible thing, I believe the racial aspect has been blown sky high out of proportion. I just moved here about a year and a half ago from Atlanta, and I remember when I first moved here, there was a young black man that raped and killed his 15-year-old white neighbor, I never heard the outcry. It's horrible no matter who it happens to, and I don't think race should be the issue. And I'm curious why this particular one got blown out of proportion as a race issue. If it happened, it's just violent, and that's what should be focused on.
All right, Stuart, thanks for your call. Has it been blown out of proportion, Ted, at the paper regarding race?
Well, I don't think the paper has made up the race issue. I mean, you've got the fact of a predominantly white lacrosse team and a African-American woman who is accusing members of that team of a pretty horrendous crime. So that race issue is already there, and I think the newspaper would be ignoring it and not serving its readers appropriately if it didn't point out those issues. That said, you know, I can't point to things that the News and Observer has written or particular stories that, if you will, hype the race issue.
Jeffrey Dvorkin is the ombudsman for NPR. He is joining us now from his post in Washington. Jeffrey, welcome.
Nice to be with you, David. And hello, Ted.
Hello, Jeffrey. Nice to talk to you.
Jeffrey, we've been talking a lot about what readers have wanted from local coverage of this alleged rape by the Duke, three members of the Duke lacrosse team. From your perspective and how NPR has covered this story, what do you sense nationally the listeners have wanted?
Well, it's been a pretty compelling story at a national level, and I understand that it has strong evocations as a local story that are often people feel that local issues become encapsulated by a story like this. And at a national level, there's much more of a broad brush stroke to telling this story. I think for a lot of listeners who have written to me, and I've had quite a few, their concern is that we make sure that we're reporting exactly what has happened and that we have an obligation to report the story while also acknowledging that this affects certain local institutions. And to try to explain that context to a national audience is what has been, I think, the challenge for NPR to do.
We're talking about the media coverage of the Duke lacrosse incident with Ted Vaden and Jeffrey Dvorkin. I'm David Crabtree. This is The State of Things. Jeffrey, I'd like to back up just a moment and ask this both of you and Ted. I'll ask you first, though. As far as being the ombudsman for NPR, exactly what does that mean?
Well, it means basically being the agent of the listener inside NPR and taking complaints and concerns, but exploring them in a kind of an independent way. I'm not acting on behalf of management, and in fact, I'm independent of management in this role. So I have both the freedom and the responsibility to look at the complaints that come in and to determine which ones are worthy of acknowledgement and investigation and which ones may not be.
And Ted is public editor of the News and Observer.
It's a very similar kind of situation. We call it public editor instead of ombudsman because we thought the latter was a pretty highfalutin title for North Carolina. But I serve as an intermediary between the readers and the news operation primarily. I am not part of the news operation. I report to the publisher and not to the editor at the News and Observer. And my job, like Jeffrey's, is to receive concerns, complaints, sift through them. I write a column each week that addresses what I think are the most significant concerns, and I also write an internal sort of newsletter for our staff each week that takes all of the reader input that we get and digests that and feed that back to the staff so they know what the readers are concerned about.
How much of an influence do readers and listeners have over the coverage of a story, how much attention that story gets, basically how it's reported on?
I think we are certainly responsive to the input that we get from readers, and I guess the lacrosse story is as good an example as any because we've just gotten hundreds and hundreds of letters and emails, and sometimes they alert us to issues of the story that we may not have thought about. I can't say that our coverage is driven by what the reader's demands or general thinking is, because basically it's got to be driven by the news, and sometimes that's an unpopular thing to do.
Jeffrey, I would presume it's a fine line in describing or feeling the pull of the influence of the listener.
Well, it is and it isn't. I think that after doing this for a few years, I think I'm developing a set of instincts that can determine when someone's writing to me as a citizen and a listener, and when someone is writing to me as part of an organized campaign. On this issue, I think all of the comments that I've received have been from listeners to public radio. I have had no sense that there has been an organized campaign to try to influence the coverage of this, at least at NPR.
This is The State of Things. We are talking today about the media frenzy that has descended upon Duke and Durham. What does this media tidal wave say about public demand for information? And we're taking your phone calls and emails, 1-877-962-9862 and SOT@WUNC.org. How do you feel about the recent media coverage? Has it been fair? Is there such a thing as too much information? Just ahead, more with Ted Vaden of the News and Observer and Jeffrey Dvorkin from NPR. You're listening to The State of Things from North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. This is The State of Things, broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm David Crabtree. We're talking today about the onslaught of media coverage that has descended upon Duke University and Durham. Is the coverage fair? Does this coverage reflect what the greater public wants to hear and read? Our phone number, 1-877-962-9862. With me today, Ted Vaden, the public editor for the News and Observer, and Jeffrey Dvorkin, the NPR ombudsman. We talk about fairness in this, and I mean, it's hard. Fairness is like trying to hold on to water. What looks fair to me may not look fair to you. Ted, as you have waded through all the email, all the telephone calls from the NNO, as you talk with reporters about their coverage, how do you find that balance in this story?
Well, you're exactly right. Fairness, to a large extent, is in the eye of the beholder. But I think if you put a lot of beholders out there together and ask them just how are we doing on this story or any other story, there does emerge a consensus of what's fair and what's not. I said earlier that I thought the NNO's coverage in the broad strokes has been fair. I've had readers raise concerns to me about specific elements of our coverage that where I agreed with them that we could have done it differently in a way that, as part of that broader mosaic of the coverage, could have been more fair.
Jeffrey, I know when Juan Williams showed up here reporting on what had happened on this story, it took on a different significance for those who listened to NPR.
Well, I think it did, and I think that one of the reasons it did is probably because Juan brings a lot of tremendous experience in reporting on issues around race. The question is that an appropriate way to proceed to cover the story? Was the use of language appropriate? I think it was. I think that I listened very carefully to Juan's reports on it, and I thought that it was a delicate story told well. And I think that one of the reasons that it was told well was because the choice of language was not inflammatory. But this is also a relative concept, of course. I would just say that in any story that evokes strong passions, we have to be careful that we are not pulling our punches, but that we're also using language that isn't incendiary. And so when just a moment ago, David, when you referred to the onslaught to describe the coverage, I mean, that's a word that comes pretty charged, I would think. For some people, it might be an onslaught. For other people, it might be an insufficient level of reporting on this story. So it all depends on where you sit and where you're listening and what you're hearing. And that's why this story has evoked a lot of passion.
Jeffrey, I've been a reporter in the television side of this business now for 26 years. And I have to admit that when I looked at our local coverage versus what the networks were doing, either the big three and a half or four, or the cable channels, I felt myself being a bit thin-skinned because I saw this area being portrayed differently than the area in which I've lived for the past dozen years, the way I know it to be. And it felt at times as an onslaught. It also felt like I wanted to say a couple of times and would call my colleagues at CBS and say, you're really missing part of the essence of this story, from my opinion, going this certain direction. So maybe it's part of the thin skin that comes in with living in an area, feeling the coverage far differently than if it's happening 600 miles from here.
Well, of course. And I think that any time a local news story is put under a national spotlight, it always feels a little bit uncomfortable. And I think that when I was a local reporter in a couple of places, it was always... there's an instinct to be kind of protective and defensive and not to allow this to get out of control. But I think that as journalists, we have an obligation to cast a cold eye on these things. And it may be painful, but it also may be valuable, too.
Well said. Let's take another call from Bob in Raleigh. Bob?
Yes, I just wanted to say that I think what affects fairness in this particular case is that the attorneys, the district attorney for Durham County and the attorneys for the accused, are saying way too much. I think they ought to be mum about a lot of things and let this be handled in court and then report what happens in court. I just, you know, this case shouldn't be tried out in the public first and then go to court. It's going to be hard to find a juror that hasn't heard about this thing.
All right, Bob, thanks for bringing that up. When the attorneys are talking, we can't turn a deaf ear.
Well, it's news. I think Bob's comment might and should be directed more at the attorneys than at the media. We have to be responsible in the way that we handle it. And one of the big stories here is the way that the district attorney, Michael Nifong, started out with his handling of the case in that he went very public and he gave 60 or 70 interviews, which then prompted the attorneys on the other side, understandably, I think, to respond to that. And the media is going to, we're scrapping for news. We're going to put in the paper what information we can get. And by the way, it's been very difficult to get official sources of information on this. We haven't been able to look at the DNA test, for instance. We haven't been able to look at much in the way of investigative records or other solid information, and so we, to a certain extent, to a large extent, are reliant on the noise that's being put out.
Let's take another call. This is Lori in Durham. Lori?
Hi, yes, thank you for taking my call. So I wanted to respond to you, the first caller who called in today and said he doesn't understand why race is an issue in this particular case as opposed to the one that he stated, which I'm not familiar with, but I think there's two important reasons that race is an issue. One is it has been determined, I believe, that these boys used racial slurs and made derogatory remarks towards these girls regarding their race. That, to me, makes it a racial issue. And the second is I think because these are white, elite, prep school boys, we don't think that they're capable of this. We think they just, this is something above their characters. I think that also makes it a race issue.
All right, Lori, thanks. Ted, do you have a response to that?
I think that Lori articulates that well. Race is an ugly undercurrent that every now and then comes to the surface, and because of the issues that she cites, we also have a predominantly white, although increasingly diverse, school, Duke University, where the lacrosse students go, and a predominantly black college, NC Central University, where the alleged victim goes. One observation I would have, I think another element that's attracted so much national attention is that this is occurring in the South, and I've wondered if this had happened in Wisconsin or Oregon or whatever, that there would have been that same level of national attention and those same sort of attitudes that come to the coverage.
Jeffrey, what do you think? Would it have been covered, or would the response, do you think, have been different had this happened outside of the South?
Well, I think Ted phrased it perfectly. And Ted is also being, I presume, Ted, you're from the area. You have the ability to say things about race in the South that others of us who are not from the South or who may not have lived in the South aren't able to say as confidently or as comfortably as you just did. And I think that when we're talking about issues that involve race and the South, the whole thing is freighted with history and a national anxiety about these questions. And I think that only by talking about them and by also hearing from people from the region who feel capable and confident about talking about these things, can we look at them in a way that is first journalistically appropriate and then culturally appropriate. So, yeah, it's a tough issue, but it's one that has to be addressed.
I'd like to bring Donald Shaw into the conversation. Professor Shaw is from the UNC School of Journalism and Mass Communication. Professor, good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
You have watched this coverage for the past 5 weeks or so. From your perspective, has it been fair? Has it been thorough?
Well, in my impression, all the local media that I have seen, and I try to monitor it as closely as I can, have made every effort to balance the message and to all the pertinent sides. It's a complicated story with a lot of public interest and a lot of media interest, and those are always very challenging to cover.
Are there special concerns and procedures we should look at when covering stories that involve race?
Well, or any other community controversy, I have a brief comment about the research shows that the mass media have a very great power in setting the agenda on the main topics, telling us what to think, what to think about, not what to think. And secondarily, that there also is recent evidence that shows the media have a very powerful influence in how the message is framed according to the attributes they use. So to answer your question is, I would say journalists have to be particularly careful to try to balance the frames and details they use. And my impression has been that the local newspapers and television have made quite an effort to try to balance those frames.
Let's take another call. This is from Mike out in the park. Mike?
Yes. Good afternoon. The concern that I have is I'm sensitive also to the race issues. I grew up in this area here. I grew up in Raleigh. But I'm not really sure that we're focusing sufficiently on what is behind the race issue. I remember one of the young ladies on one of the local newscasts stating that if the Duke players had been black, that they would be in jail. Now, that's that is a perception there, and the perception is a part of the race issue. Are we digging to see if those perceptions indeed have any legitimacy in fact?
Don Shaw?
Well, it's kind of hard for me to know exactly how to answer that question, other than to be sensitive to all the elements. The earlier comment about being Southern, I think, being in the Southern region next, it's pertinent to try to look at the issues of race, I agree, and issues of class and the history and so forth. But this story has a little bit of everything. It has race and class and possibly race and sex and possibly even a bit of social class. And by and large, I think journalists simply have to do the best they can to balance. If the journalists can only try to balance, they can't know how it's going to be received. If people have very intense feelings about it, no matter how objectively the journalist approaches the topic, they're likely to not be received as objective by somebody with very strong views. So journalists can't always just depend on how the audience will react to messages to know whether or not they're doing a fair job. They have to appeal to their own professional sense of balance and craftsmanship.
Have we, as collective media, given too much opportunity to all sides to spin this story the way they want it?
I don't know how you can do otherwise as a responsible journalist but to provide as many different perspectives as is reasonably possible. And then the public has to have some responsibility for interpreting it within the framework of their own sense of fairness and judgment.
But we self-edit. I mean, in that huge question of withholding the name of the accuser, I mean, we're spun both sides on that issue, and yet we make our own decisions. So are we being framed by the sides, or are we framing part of their argument?
Well, that would, in my view, whether the local media are treating it is fair-minded with that long-standing policy. If it goes into court, of course, the situation will change. I mean, I think that you have to be kind of careful because you know so much about the, so to speak, Duke side of it, that the other side of it be treated fairly. And to some extent, you may have hobbled yourself, but on the other hand, you have this policy, and I would tend to adhere to it.
Ted, I would presume there have been conversations about this, somewhat maybe intense conversations at the paper?
Yeah, that was one of the issues that I raised in one of my columns was shortly after all this came out, the News and Observer had the first and only, as far as I'm aware, interview with the accuser. And because the News and Observer has a policy of not identifying alleged victims of sex crimes, we did this interview without obviously saying what her name is and allowed her some latitude to make accusations and representations about what occurred, which may be true, which may not be true, but on an anonymous basis. But, of course, on the other side, the lacrosse players, we have identified their names publicly even before they were indicted, and we did not give them the opportunity, same opportunity, to comment on the case anonymously. We did give them the opportunity to comment by name, but their lawyers are advising them not to talk about it.
We're talking about how media responds to public sentiment with Ted Vadim, Jeffrey Dvorkin, and Don Shaw. I'm David Crabtree. This is The State of Things. Don Shaw, when we look at this story and we look at the intense coverage by the national media, particularly with the 24-hour news cycle that we see with the cable channels now, if we could roll back time 15 years before the proliferation of cable TV the way we know it today, would we see this story on a newscast every night? Would we hear it on the radio most every day, read about it in the local newspapers most every day?
That's a hard question to answer. My guess is you'd see quite a bit of it, even back then, because this story has strong elements of news conflict interest and audience interest, and I think you would see probably a bit less, but it would still be there a lot, even then.
May I comment on that?
Would you please?
It's Jeffrey Dvorkin. About 10 years ago, I was asked to give some discussions at a university in the South to a journalism school, and I was talking to a graduating class, and I said, well, if we were going to treat this class as a story meeting, what is the biggest story on campus today, and how would we treat that? There was dead silence in the room, and it was mostly, I have to say, mostly women in the room, there were a couple of men, and one of the men spoke up, and he said, well, we could do a story about all the rapes on campus. Dead silence in the room, glowers from the women, and I thought, this is something strange going on here, and I asked this young man to explain, and he said, well, you know, we got a lot of fraternities and on this campus, and they keep inviting strippers into their parties, and then they rape them, and they throw them out, and the police charge them with trespassing, and nothing ever gets done. And there was, you know, I said, well, that sounds like quite a story. And one of the women in the class who was doing most of the glowering said, you know, you're asking me to choose between being a journalist and being a Greek, that is to say, a member of a sorority or a fraternity. And she said, if I have to choose between those two, I'll always choose to be a Greek. I was so shocked that a journalism school, which I'll go nameless at this point, had allowed that those kinds of values to percolate up into their senior class. I suggested to the head of the journalism school that they needed a session in remedial ethics to figure this one out. And I think that what's happened with this story at Duke has actually been very healthy. There's been I sense a kind of a journalistic letting go and opening up of this story. And I think it's been a tremendously important and well-done story, even though it's enormously painful. But if I have to compare that to this other Southern University town that I visited almost 10 years ago, I think the journalism around this has been enormously positive.
I might add, too, that to pursue that is that many universities now are looking at the behavior, including my own, various teams and so forth. And I'd have to say that the glare of publicity is a good thing.
Don Shaw, let me ask you to hold that thought for just a moment. Okay. We are talking about the media coverage of the alleged rape of a Durham woman by members of the Duke lacrosse team. With us today, Ted Vaden from the News and Observer, Jeffrey Dvorkin from NPR, and Don Shaw, professor at the UNC School of Journalism and Mass Communication. Just ahead, more of your phone calls at 1-877-962-9862 on the State of Things. This is The State of Things. I'm David Crabtree. We're talking this hour about media coverage in the age of the 24-hour news cycle. How should we assess the coverage of the alleged rape of a Durham woman by members of the Duke lacrosse team? Joining me today, Ted Vaden, public editor of the News and Observer, Jeffrey Dvorkin, the ombudsman for NPR, Don Shaw, professor of the UNC School of Journalism and Mass Communications. And we're taking your calls at email 1-877-962-9862. And SOT at WUNC.org. Have you found the local coverage of this story satisfying? What about the national coverage? Professor, just before that break, I stopped you if you'd like to finish that thought.
Well, to me, obviously, being a journalist and now a journalism teacher, I favor open information, and clearly that story, altogether aside from the issues of the parties involved in it, brings a lot of attention to the behavior of athletic teams. And as I pointed out, even at my own university, there's been a renewed interest in that, and looking at records and behavior and so forth, and a series of stories over here. And I don't think it's a bad thing for us to be aware of nuances of behavior of teams that I never even had thought about before. So I think it's a good thing, in a way, that this, I'm sorry for the individuals involved, of course, and that we've come to it, but still, I think many events show issues about which we should have more publicity.
Ted Vaden, you had mentioned to me that if this had been 10 or 15 years ago, one of the reasons it would be different, no internet.
Right. A big difference that you cited was the increase of cable television and talk radio, Rush Limbaugh, et cetera. But what's really different now that I think is feeding, if you want to call this a media frenzy, is the presence of the internet and particularly bloggers out there. And there's just a ton of communication that's going on and dissemination of information by individuals who are blogging and, in effect, are self-publishers, providing their own take on this story to audiences far and wide. Much of the comments that I've gotten from readers have been from Texas, California, et cetera. And often it's the same thread to their message, and you pick up that they have been reading the same blogger, and that blogger is telling them what's going on here, and often their information is not well informed.
You know, and it used to be that radio and television were the immediate facilitators of information. The paper had to wait to be published. Now with your website, which is extensive at the News and Observer, you're in that game of immediacy as well, and it raises the tension level in editorial meetings with reporter to reporter, seeing something pop up on the web, somebody else has something. Are we falling into that trap of rushing sometimes far too quickly to get this information out there?
Well, I think it gooses along the competitive element to a much greater extent than is existed previously, because you can You know, it used to be we printed once every 24 hours, but now we can go online instantly. So does WRAL. So do the other media that we're talking about. So it does put pressure on you to go to print earlier than you might have otherwise. I think the News and Observer has done a good job of being responsible about that. But nevertheless, it's a different kind of environment that we're producing information in.
And I would like to add, too, generally speaking, traditional journalism, newspapers and television and radio, provide the first look at events. They provide the subject and the initial, what I call, frames or attributes or details. And by and large, they're usually, even if they're too speedily put together, they're edited and they looked at and they're the best judgment at the time. A lot of times the bloggers and others who use the new emerging media select some portion of the story, some attribute of the story with which they're particularly distressed or happy, and that becomes their story. It's not the same thing as a professional journalist story.
Eric Umansky, go right ahead, Jeffrey.
I'm sorry to jump in like that. I agree with Don Shaw. I mean, it's the difference between fact-based reporting and faith-based reporting. I mean, we have a lot of opinion floating around out there that can disguise itself as being fact-based reporting. I think that what our obligation is to try to help our listeners, viewers, and readers determine what is based on fact and what is based on opinion.
Right.
Eric Umansky writes the Today's Paper feature at Slate.com. He's joining us now from his office. Eric, welcome.
Thanks for having me.
Sure. You have been watching the coverage of this story as it has unfolded over the past 4 or 5 weeks. As far as the national coverage is concerned, do you think it's been fair and balanced?
I think it's been fair and balanced. I think as in most stories, actually, that involve a court case, which you're often hearing is one side's version, it's very difficult to distinguish that. And I think as some of the other folks on the program were just saying, is one of the challenges is to make clear when you're actually when you're just giving one side's version. And so, for example, when you hear about the photos, well, where'd you get the photos? To give as much context as possible. Because I don't know that you can be perfectly fair and balanced, but what you can try to do is give as much context as possible.
Well, because of the nature of this story, does it deserve the attention it has so far received?
My inclination, frankly, is no. I mean, I think, I'll be honest, that's as much as a visceral reaction on my part as anything. But I've been thinking about that, and I think that I understand it, that it certainly taps into larger issues in America, but I sort of recoil when it turns into this big kind of media frenzy, as someone just said. And I think that as much as it raises important issues about America, there's also, to be blunt about it, an entertainment aspect to it.
Okay, that sort of leads me into the next question I was going to ask you. Is this coverage driven by a true desire for knowledge by viewers and listeners and readers, or there are some of us within the media have taken this and sensationalized, I don't want to use that word, but have we in some ways pushed to make this more than it is?
Well, I think that sensationalized is a sort of easy word to put on it, but I think that it does touch on, it does sort of touch nerves of American society, of class and race, and I think people are fascinated then by the story, or many people are fascinated by the story. So does that mean that it's necessarily, the interest in it is necessarily a result of sort of sensationalism? I don't know that, but I do kind of then get the feeling of wanting to keep a bit of distance from it, frankly.
Eric, we know you've got a very busy schedule. You've got to get back to work. Thanks to you for stealing away a few minutes and talking with us on this issue.
Thanks very much for having me.
Eric Umansky writes the Today's Paper feature at Slate.com. Let's get back to the phone. Several people waiting. Garrett?
Yes. Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I just wanted to say that I have just recently relocated down to the Raleigh area from the New Hampshire and Maine area of the country, and I'm a bit confused, and I'm a bit ashamed in a way thinking that I didn't believe that these types of issues would have raised so much interest as the way it has down here, as opposed to what I would have heard back at home. And I guess I guess when the question comes up is, does the media play such a big part of this? I can't help but believe that the media has played a big role in this.
I mean, what has bothered you, the fact that it's the specifics of this case or how we as media have portrayed it?
I believe it's how the media has portrayed it. I hate to use the term, the race card has been played here, but it seems that by bringing that up as an issue, it certainly raises enough eyebrows to bring this to the forefront and make it a national media attention, opposed to treating it as serious as it is, an accusation of a rape, but just left in the merits of a rape. Would it have become a national issue?
All right, Garrett, thanks for your call. Let's get some response. Ted?
Well, Eric mentioned the importance of trying to provide context, and I think in this case, race is part of the issue, as I've said previously. I don't think that we need to make it the primary issue. In fact, you could make the argument that class is the issue as much as it is race, and the news media do have a responsibility to provide that kind of context to it. But again, as I said earlier, if we ignore the race angle to it, or if we don't give it, if we don't examine it in context, then I think we're not doing our readers a service.
Let's take another call. This is from Joy in Raleigh. Joy?
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
It's become a national issue because it's Duke. If it was a small little college somewhere in the boonies, we might not have ever heard that this has happened. And I have worked in one of the state universities, and I know that a lot of drinking goes on and a lot of this kind of behavior goes on, but it's also the mentality of boys will be boys, and that's the problem for us. In this culture, in this particular culture, African women have always been abused, but because now we have the media, it is now very, the light is on, the camera is on, and the light is on, so it can't be shoved back in the box. We are dealing with an issue of race, class, and gender, and we're dealing with an issue of the powerful and the powerless. I would like us to not, for the media to refrain from referring to this young woman as quote-unquote, a stripper.
All right, Joy, let's get some response. Thank you for your call. She prompts a very good thought here to you, Ted, and Don, and Jeffrey. There have been labels placed on this, whether she is an exotic dancer, she is a stripper, or the fact that she is a mother of children and a student working her way through school. And yet, on cable TV, we have also seen banners go up that says Duke rape scandal. This incident did not happen on the campus of Duke University. We don't yet know in the court of law if a rape happened. We do know that it's a serious problem. We throw these names out there, and they are attached to Duke University, to the lacrosse team, to these players. Is that fair to do? Don?
Well, if I do not know how much access to the young woman there is, but obviously if I were a journalist and had opportunity to present a more rounded picture of her than I have thus far been able to read, I probably would do some of that. But I'm not sure how accessible that is, or even how far you could go, because you got the identity problem issue. But I understand the criticism. To me, it is not quite to the level where it's bothersome as your question would imply.
Well, I have fought that battle in my newsroom and lost on some of the labeling. Just simply, it made me feel uncomfortable as a journalist, as a person who lives in this region, to slap that label up there until we know for sure exactly what may or may not have happened. Ted?
Well, I think the News and Observer has tried to avoid inflammatory labels. My impression is that, for instance, it stayed away from the word stripper and used exotic dancer. And in fact, if the information we have is correct, that really the woman really wasn't a stripper. She'd worked for an escort service for a period of time, and this supposedly was her first gig as an exotic dancer. It's kind of hard to avoid making a lot of reference to Duke, headlines and otherwise, because that's what the story's about. And I think we do have to be very careful about using the word rape when we haven't, when that hasn't been proven.
We're talking about the media coverage of the Duke lacrosse incident with Ted Vaden, Jeffrey Dvorkin, and Don Shaw. I'm David Crabtree. This is The State of Things. Let's go back to the phones, take another call. This from Taiki and Carrie.
Hi. I had 2 points, one of which was extremely well made by the person who just spoke about the labeling of the exotic dancer or the working mother. But the other point is that I think that Duke's relationship with the community has been portrayed in a really divisive way. And there are a lot of things that Duke does for Durham that are really positive that have completely disappeared in this, coverage. And, for example, next week, Duke's donating the use of their auditorium to Chuck Davis's African-American Dance Ensemble, and he's got a dance group out of Durham, and, as you might suspect, his African-American Dance Ensemble is mostly made up of black performers, and they're hosting a group of people that's coming from Haiti, the Resurrection Dance Theater. And Duke has not only donated the use of their auditorium, but they've also provided scholarship funds so that some of the public schools in Durham can have access to this performance as well. So I know that, you can't completely characterize Duke's relationship with the community in one way or another, but I think it's that the national coverage and even the local coverage is really not focused on some of the positive interactions that Duke has with the community.
Taiki, thank you very much for your call. She raises an interesting point. However, we do report on these things throughout the year when Duke is involved or any other university or nonprofits are involved with community service. It's when the negative incidents happen for organizations, universities, business, governments, whatever it may be, that it becomes news. And that's hard for readers and listeners and viewers to get their hands around sometimes, isn't it?
Yeah. Unfortunately, good news doesn't make news as much as bad news does. I wouldn't entirely blame the media for that, because I think we perceive that's what the readers want us to present to them. At the same time, we do present plenty of good news, and I don't doubt that the Chuck Davis story would have been covered. But I would make the point that the relationship between Duke and the neighborhood and the community is a huge story, and there should be a lot more done on that.
That is the state of things for today. I want to say thanks to our guest. Ted Vaden is the public editor for the News and Observer. Jeffrey Dvorkin is the ombudsman for NPR. Don Shaw is a professor at the University of North Carolina School of Journalism and Mass Communication. My thanks to all of you, and thanks for listening. If you have a comment about our show or want to hear archived editions of past programs, go to our website at stateofthings.org. Our show is produced by Megan Davis and Katie Barron. The technical director is Robin Copley. We had help this week from John Rose and John Blythe. Dave DeWitt is our managing editor. Susan Davis is our senior producer. This is North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. I'm David Crabtree.